supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Well, pets, they rarely judge or complain, and when we're blue, they can make us smile. Overall, many of us see them as a natural mood adjusters or suppliers or of unconditional love, kind of fuzzy antidepressants. But are they really? We've heard all the studies claiming that owning pets is beneficial to our physical and mental health, but now we're hearing, well, that ain't necessarily so. On today's show, we'll discuss conflicting data around pet ownership with two psychologists who have written on this subject. Later on, we'll hear about service and therapy dogs, and we'll also hear from a woman whose pet provides inspiration to her and hundreds and thousands of others who suffer from physical challenges. But first, I'm joined by psychologist Drs. Alan McConnell and Harold Hal Herzog. Alan McConnell's a professor of psychology at the University of Miami. He's co-authored Friends with Benefits on the Positive Consequences of Pet Owners. Alan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dan.
Hal Herzog teaches psychology at Western Carolina University. He's written Some We Love, Some We Hate, and Some We Eat. It's now out in paperback. His article, The Impact of Pets on Human Health and Psychological Well-Being, Fact, Fiction, or Hypothesis, is published in this month's Current Directions in Psychological Science. Hal, welcome to you.
Hi, Dan. Hi, Alan.
Hi.
Well, our number is 888-477-9499. I'm just guessing there are pet owners out there who want to call in and express their feelings about whether pets are beneficial or not. Again, the number is 888-477-9499. So, Hal, you come out with your book that's kind of equivocal, your position about whether pets are helpful to us or not. I'm just guessing, in some of your public appearances, you've caught hell, my friend.
Oh, yeah. You can see my mail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I read that. I wanted to take you out in the alley myself.
Well, by the way, I am a pet lover myself.
Really?
And have always had pets. And I was actually surprised, and I've been doing research in this area for 20 years, and I was actually surprised when I actually sat down and looked at literally hundreds of articles, and I found that the data were a lot more the data on the health benefits of pets were a lot more mixed than I had anticipated.
So let's come to the title of your book, Some We Love, Some We Hate, and Some We Eat. What does this say about us?
Well, the book is not primarily about pets. There's a chapter on pets. But what it says about us is that our interactions with animals are, first of all, very, very important in our lives, and even though psychologists have largely ignored them. But it also says that we are conflicted about animals so much that some animals we put in the category of members of our family. We let them sleep in our bed. We love them dearly. And then other animals that are very, very similar biologically, we love to eat. And we, it's part of human nature, I think, to have to deal with these sort of moral conflicts. And they really come out in our relations with pets.
Yeah, they sure do. Alan, how did you come to this field of study?
Well, I should first say that I'm a pet lover, too, but I actually don't have a pet of my own at the moment. So put that on the table.
Well, you love, wait a minute. You love other people's pets?
I do. I have lots of friends who have great dogs and cats, and I enjoy spending time with them, but I personally don't have any pet.
You never did?
I grew up on a farm, so I had lots of animals around, some that I loved, some that I ate, you know, kind of going along with Hal's book.
Right. Right.
But, you know, we had dogs and cats, but for most of my adult life, I've not had a pet.
How come?
Honestly, I'm really busy, and I take that responsibility of pet ownership quite seriously. And I hope someday to have a pet, but at the moment, with work and lots of other responsibilities, I just feel like I wouldn't have the sort of time to devote to a pet that I think a pet would deserve.
Well, that's really interesting, because Hal, one of the points you make in your book is that there is a potential downside that goes with pet ownership, and that's you're talking beyond those little annoying plastic bags we have to carry to pick up their poop, which is really weird to me.
It is weird.
Yeah. So,
well, yeah, I mean, there's some medical downside. You know, 85,000 people a year are taken to hospital emergency rooms because they trip over their pets, usually old people.
Wow.
1,000 people a day are taken to emergency rooms, mostly children, because they're bit by their pet. They're bitten by, you know, dog bites. And dogs or pets are second to late night noise as a source of conflict between neighbors. That being said, I think there's tremendous. I think pets can add tremendously to people's quality of life.
Mm, of course. Tell us about the couple you wrote about in your book, Hal. The couple that nearly divorced.
They did divorce. Yeah, this was a couple. I talk about two couples in my pet chapter. I mean, not two couples, two cases. One was a case where a cat, living with a cat, I think, almost saved a woman's life. Kept her out of a nursing home. It's her best friend, and she's doing great, largely because of her cat. But the other was a couple who got a pair of dogs, and conflicts over the dogs. The dogs were very high maintenance. The dogs basically ruined their life. And when I interviewed them, it was a fascinating interview. I interviewed them. I said, well, this must be sort of tough on your marriage. And they looked at me, and they said, well, we're seeing a counselor. And then 2 weeks later, they called me and said that they had decided to get divorced, largely because of conflicts associated in their lives with the pets. I don't think that's true for most people, but this idea that pets are always good for people is the idea that I object to.
Huh. So, consistent with that, let's go to the phones. We've got a caller. Joseph? Joseph?
Yes.
Hi.
Yes.
You're on the air. Are you there?
I'm listening to a conference call.
Pardon? Hello? Joseph? No. I guess we lost that call. His point was that pets can provide more stress than relaxation, and that's consistent with what you were just saying. Hal, you say there isn't strong evidence for the general claim that living with a pet makes us happier and healthier, yet studies abound. There's plenty of research that shows that people with HIV positive are less depressed when they have pets, or that the elderly have fewer doctor visits.
Well, there's what I found. I believed that too until I wrote my chapter on pets, and I started amassing, you know, file drawers full of studies, and I began to put them into three piles. One was a pile showing positive benefits of pets, which are a lot of those studies have been done by friends of mine. And then I put into a pile the studies which have found no differences. And then I had a smaller pile, but a substantial pile, of which pet owners were actually doing worse. And so I was surprised, because I had always sort of bought this idea. I've been, you know, in this field for, you know, over 20 years, and I had always bought the idea that the evidence is substantial that pets were good for people. In reality, the evidence is very, very mixed. Well, you know, for example, even if you look at Alan's recent study, I think was just tremendous, and it was he's exactly the type of person we need doing this research, a really good methodologist. But if you look at the measures in his study, he found that there were no differences in the happiness of pet owners and non-owners, in the depression levels or the health of pet owners. And, you know, so some studies have found pet owners are happier than non-pet owners. Other studies have found that they're no happier. And that's what I found, as I found a complete mixed bag of research, and I was pretty unprepared for that.
Well, let me reintroduce you both here. You were just listening to Hal Herzog. He's a professor of psychology at Western Carolina University. He's written Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat. It's now out in paperback. I'm also joined by Alan McConnell. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Miami, and he's co-authored Friends with Benefits on the Positive Consequences of Pet Ownership. Right now, we're talking about the conflicting research that's in around pet ownership. Later on in the show, we're going to talk about canine companions. We're going to meet a woman whose pet, in many respects, saved her life. And that's what we're talking about, pets. We'd love to hear from you also. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Alan, tell us about your study.
Well, we basically conducted three experiments that are reported in the paper that just came out in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. And the first study was just looking to see whether there were differences between pet owners and non-pet owners in a community sample. So this was the study that Hal was referring to there. And we found what I would characterize as modest differences on a number of the measures and no differences on the others. But each and every time we saw a difference, it tended to suggest that pet owners were better off. They tended to be less lonely. They tended to have higher self-esteem. They tended to have greater physical fitness. Their personality types, again, when there were differences observed, were healthier. They were more extroverted. They were more conscientious. Their relationship styles tended to be more positive. They were less fearful and preoccupied in the ways that they view relationships. So, but that was just kind of an initial foray. And again, there were a number of variables there where there were no differences at all.
Well, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. The ones who are better off, is that cause or effect? I mean, do people with a certain personality type, people who are happier, healthier, more open, are they more likely to have pets?
Yeah, and that's a real concern with a lot of studies reported in the literature, including, you know, the study that I just described, that it's all correlational. So you don't really know, do certain healthier types of people gravitate toward pets? Do people who have, you know, more financial means or better health so they can maintain and care for a pet, are they more likely? So you really have no idea about cause and effect from correlational studies. Although I would point out there are a number of studies in the literature where people have, through random assignment, been either given a pet or not given a pet, or you're able to track people who were on waitlisted controls and kind of a clinical sort of trial that have shown benefits from pets. And in our third study, we had an experimental manipulation as well. So I think there's, you know, a number of studies where when you randomize people or you can experimentally produce different sorts of conditions, you can show differences. But an awful lot of the research that out there is correlational, so it's suggestive, but it's certainly far from conclusive.
You're bringing up about 700 issues I want to bring up with both of you, but let's go to the phones. We've got Louise on the line. Hi, Louise.
Good morning.
Good
morning. Or afternoon.
Close.
The reason I was calling was the idea when I dated and when my daughters dated, whether a person was a dog lover was a deal breaker. And I have a friend who's dating now, and she said if the person has a dog, that's a deal breaker in the opposite. She's not interested in it. So I just wondered whether you're... guests had any comments about whether this idea of loyalty to dogs can overcome true love.
Either one of you want to comment on that? Because I think that is, you know, addressed. Well, you know, I touched on that in the opening of the show, that, you know, we love our pets and we love to love them, and I would suggest as a clinician that some people are safer loving pets and there's less risk. To make a commitment to a human is great risk, and you know, we might want to stick with those we feel safe with, you know, the people who are passionately anti-pet might be that for other reasons. But I think those who say, you know, my dog or my cat stay with me is like saying, you know, this is my lover, and I don't want to take any risks. And I'm not suggesting that we are anthropomorphizing our pets to be lovers, but, you know, they are much like our children, and we're just not going to let them go so easily.
If I could just add real quickly, one thing that we did look at in our experiments were whether there were differences between, you know, cat owners and dog owners on a variety of measures. Because I think there's a lot of cultural stereotypes about, you know, dog lovers are like this or cat lovers are like that. And, you know, from the caller's observation, it sounds like some people would even use that as a litmus test for who they date. But interestingly, we didn't find differences, say, between cat and dog owners with respect to their personality types or their relationship styles. So to me, I think a lot of these stereotypes about what a dog person or a cat person are culturally transmitted and may in some ways produce self-fulfilling prophecies. But at least from our data and a number of other studies, it doesn't seem like these sort of differences are really borne out when you give people actual validated measures.
I totally agree with that. I completely agree. I consider myself a dog person, but now my wife and I have a cat, and I completely agree. I think Alan's right about it. I think the difference between dog and cat people has been way overblown.
Yeah, it really flies in the face of traditional wisdom. I got to tell you, one of my favorite cartoons from New Yorker magazine is a picture of a dog and a cat laying in bed next to each other, and the cat's reading Balls of Yarn Monthly, and the dog is reading Dogs Who Love Too Much, and the cat's saying, "I'm not being aloof. I'm a freaking cat," which really captures it. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Andrea on the line. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, Dr. Dan. I just wanted to tell a story about how my little puppy doesn't just make me happy, but I swear she cured me of kind of mild OCD most of my life, just concerned about germs and contamination and orderliness. And I'm just generally kind of with a high-stress kind of person. I got this little puppy in December, and not only do I suddenly not care if her dirty paws are on the sofa or if she brings a worm in or anything like that, I have no reason to be anxious about anything. Like, if something goes wrong, suddenly I know how to say, it's not the end of the world, it's no big deal, and it's all because of her. I mean, I'm 34, and I've been that way most of my life. Not anymore.
So what your dog taught you was that germs can be happy and lovable.
Yeah, that you know what, sometimes you have a little bit of germs and just to get, you know, the fun and love that you get from this dog. And I also kind of realized that, and I kind of apply this to people now, too, that if she does something wrong or something that bothers me, she's not doing it to make me angry. She's just, that's what she does. And I was like, wow, I could probably apply that to people I work with, friends, family, whatever. And she did this all to me since December. So, I don't know. For me, I mean, she doesn't just make me happy. She really has been a life changer.
Andrea, thanks so much for your call. What do you guys make of this? I'll start with you, Alan. Caller after caller, and I'm sure everywhere you go and whatever you read, there's anecdotal evidence after anecdotal evidence, and it's got to add up to something.
Well, I guess, you know, I think one thing that Hal communicates pretty well in his paper is that I think if we try to boil this down to pets, are they good or bad, is way overly simplistic. And I think in psychology and in, you know, sciences more generally, we start with these first generation questions, which are, you know, is it X or is it Y? And then we accumulate a lot of evidence showing that sometimes it's X and sometimes it's Y. And then that leads us to kind of second generation questions, like under what conditions are pets good or bad, or for whom are pets, you know, a positive factor or a negative factor in their life? And I think that's really where we're getting now, is that, you know, there are findings that suggests a lot of benefits to pets, and there are some that aren't. But I think what we have to rely on, though, is a lot of accumulated research to draw that determination. If we rely on anecdotal evidence, that can be really compelling and often a really great starting point for generating good research. But in the end, you know, it's very easy to find any story that supports one side or the other, but you have to really get a good body of research out there and then begin to kind of put it all together on the table and say, well, what can we draw from this? And where are the limits and where are the moderators and things like that? And I think that's where we are now in a lot of this research. It's not just pets good, pets bad, but trying to understand under what conditions or what factors make pets more beneficial.
You've both raised questions about the biological mechanism that creates well-being with pets. But it seems to me, now this might get back to what you were saying about making it more person-animal specific, but it seems to me when you are with a being that you feel great love for, I mean, that releases cortisol in their brain, and that we know is associated with well-being. It doesn't seems pretty simple to me. How?
I can take that. It's not as simple as that. And so, for example, there's been studies of oxytocin. Oxytocin, the so-called right. love hormone, social bonding hormone. And I know four oxytocin studies now.
Right.
One found a positive effect. One found a positive effect in women, but not in men. In fact, it actually decreased in men. One found an effect only in owners who were gazing at their dog, and the fourth one found no effect at all. So we really don't know yet. And cortisol is a good example.
Diminished.
Very difficult to measure. But I want to say one. I know we got too much time, but I think what's happened, and I think the fact that both Alan and my paper came out roughly the same time in good psychology journals is that scientists are finally starting to take these relationships seriously. Mainstream scientists are starting to take these seriously. And so, for example, the National Institutes of Health is combined with the Mars Corporation, which is actually makes a lot of dog food. They're a pet company. And they're putting millions of dollars into basic research. I just got back from Washington from an NIH panel and looking at some studies that are going to answer exactly these questions, really, really well designed.
So we can look to getting more information in the future, and maybe having you guys on in about a year or so. We've got to take a break. We've got other guests we want to bring on. We're going to hear from Sarah Lee Perel. She's a nationally syndicated columnist whose dog Amazing Gracie became her caregiver. And we're also going to hear from Corrine Levy. She's volunteers for Canine Companions. Will you guys stay on? Because we've got a ton of callers.
Sure.
My guests are Harold Herzog, Hal, a professor of psychology at Western Carolina University, Alan McConnell. He's a professor of psychology at Western Miami. Well, like I said, we'll be back after a short break. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Do you have love, time, or resources to help one child? Bethany Christian Services, a national nonprofit adoption agency, envisions a world where every child has a loving family. Since 1944, Bethany has provided adoption and foster care services, licensed in more than 30 states, including Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. To learn ways to care for vulnerable children in our region and around the world, 800-215-0702 or bethany.org. Bethany Christian Services supports WHYY.
At the heart of everything we do at WHYY is one thing, storytelling. We try to inform, engage, inspire, and connect through deep, colorful stories. And NewsWorks Tonight brings together the best reporting from our network of journalists in one smart, lively regional news magazine. Weeknights at 6 on WHYY-FM, or listen online at WHYY.org and NewsWorks.org. There's also the podcast, and you can follow NewsWorks Tonight on Twitter and Facebook. And that's the story.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about our relationship with our pets. Are they helpful? Are they not helpful? We will find out. Well, we are finding out. And we're talking with Hal Herzog, a professor of psychology at Western Carolina University, and Alan McConnell, professor of psychology at the University of Miami. In just a few minutes, we're going to hear from Sarah Lee Perel, a syndicated and award-winning columnist, and she'll talk about her dog, amazing Gracie, who helped her with her spinal cord injury 8 years ago. And in a few minutes, we'll also hear from Corinne Levy. She's with Volunteers for Canine Companions. But I want to take a few more callers with you guys, Harold and Alan, before I know you have to go. So let's bring on Susan. We have Susan on the line. We have Susan on the line. Hi, Susan. You're on Voices.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, and thank you for having the show.
Sure.
I just want to say that I suffered through 3 consecutive miscarriages, and if I hadn't had my dog, who was an East Siberian Laika, they're known to be very protective and intelligent, I don't think I would have survived or recovered from those losses. I still have her now. I've had her for over 15 years, and she has kept me, you know, sane in a sense. I mean, I consider myself to be semi-stable to begin with, but having her to distract me and for me to give love to and vice versa, it's just really been one of the best relationships in my life. So I'm here to say that healthy people can have healthy, loving relationships with dogs. She didn't replace children, and she doesn't replace my relationships with people, but it meant a lot to me to have her by my side through all of this.
Well, that makes all the sense in the world. It's, you know, it is about love, and love does help heal pain. Hal, any reaction to what Susan's saying?
Oh, I hear lots of stories like that, and I totally believe them. There's no question about it. For some people, some of the times, these can be incredibly helpful, important relationships, and I'm not trying to denigrate them. I'm simply saying that if we actually look at the empirical research, it's very mixed, and we need a lot more studies. We need studies like this case to find out why these relationships work so well and are so important for some people and so life-saving, but yet for other people they don't have anywhere near the same effect.
Which is,
by the way, something Alan found in his study.
Alan, could you just conjecture for us what some of the biological mechanisms might be here?
Well, I guess if I could, I can come back to that in a second. I guess one thing I would add about the caller's observation and really, you know, poignant story there is that in our second study, we try to explore this very question about how, you know, do people, when they draw on pets and receive benefits, you know, how does this look in relationship to their other forms of human social support? Because when we conducted our study, we actually expected to find that the benefits of pet ownership would be more pronounced for people who had poor human social support. You know, sort of the person would rely on pets when their human relationships maybe weren't as positive or as available. And much to our surprise, we actually found completely the opposite, which was as people had closer and more positive relationships with parents and siblings and best friends, they actually derived more support from their pet. So rather than it being a situation where, you know, it was the people who don't connect well with people who relied on their pets, we actually found people with better human social support received more benefits from their pets as well. So that, I think, you know, kind of contrary to a lot of people's expectations there, that it might just be only the people who don't have good human social support can benefit from pets.
We've got to go to another break. I know we've got to say goodbye to you, but I just one final question. Hal, you said that the notion that pets have psychological benefits has really led to a blurring between what we consider companion animals and service animals and so forth. How so?
Well, normally, you know, service animals started out as guide dogs, so they had a specific function, but especially when people started thinking of pets as, you know, providing psychological support, there was this proliferation of service animals designed for things, you know, to provide psychological support. And so, for example, one guy wanted to take his boa constrictor into Walmart because it provided him with psychological support. A hostess was telling me on an airplane that she was in the plane one time and somebody had brought their pot-bellied, their miniature pig on the plane to provide them with social, psychological support. And this has gotten to be a problem enough that the Americans with Disabilities Act was actually changed earlier this year, so that service animals are only including dogs that are specially trained and believe it or not, miniature horses. So this blurring between what's a pet and what becomes a treatment, for example, your social anxiety disorder, has become somewhat problematic, even in a legal sense. You know, if you want to go into a restaurant that doesn't allow pets, but you have a service animal that helps you get along with other people, what's the legal status of that?
Yeah, that's really interesting, and really sets up our discussion that we're going to have in just a few minutes with Corinne Levy with Canine Companions. Well, I want to thank you guys so very much, and I appreciate the research you're doing. I'm a little disappointed because, you know, I was hoping to set up a really heated argument between you two, but you're acting like typical psychologists.
I hate that.
All right.
That's a compliment.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for the work you do. We've been talking with Harold Herzog, a professor of psychology at Western Carolina University. He writes about the impact of pets on human health and psychological well-being, and Alan McConnell, professor of psychology at the University of Miami, and he co-authored Friends with Benefits on the Positive Consequences of Pet Ownership. Well, we'll be back in just one brief minute. We'll be talking with someone from Canine Companions. We'll also be talking with Sarah Lee Perel, who will be talking about Gracie, her dog. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
On the next Fresh Air, someone else's twin. Psychologist Nancy Siegel tells us about a twin who was separated at birth, but later ran into her identical sibling at a shopping mall. Also, birds do it, bees do it. Biologist Marlene Zook explains sex on six legs, lessons on life, love, and language from the insect world. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
What do South Korea, Senegal, Iran, and Estonia have in common? They represent some of the best and worst in the world when it comes to getting online. But where does the U.S. stand?
The United States has fallen in terms of internet prowess.
A look at the internet around the world, next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about our relationship with our pets. We are joined now by Sarah Lee Perel. She's a nationally syndicated award-winning columnist whose dog, Amazing Gracie, became her 24/7 caregiver after she suffered an inexplicable spinal cord injury 8 years ago. Sarah Lee, welcome to the show. Do we have you? We must have a line that's down. We'll come back to her in just one second. And we're also joined by Corinne Levy, who volunteers for Canine Companions as a service dog puppy raiser here in Philadelphia. Corinne, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And I know we have Sarah Lee back on the line. Hi, Sarah Lee.
Hi, is that better?
Yeah, that's much better.
What a way to start.
You sound terrific. Well, we all start in silence. You know, that's how everything begins.
Good to hear.
So let's start with you. Your Facebook page, which has had maybe a gazillion hits, is called...
You want some help?
I'm sorry. Oh, it's called Gracie, My Four-Footed Coach. I'm sorry. My brain just fell asleep for a minute.
Let me help you, because, of course, I would love people to participate in that page, but I should give you the correct title. It's called Sarah Lee Perrell Presents Gracie, My Four-Footed Coach.
So tell us about the relationship with you and Gracie. How did you meet, and how did the relationship evolve over the years?
The relationship with Gracie began when she was 1 year old, and I was fine. I was fine physically, and she and Bob connected like two peas in a pod. She was 1 year old and adopted from a rescue, and just connected instantly with Bob, and loved me, and I loved her. But the oddest thing, shall I continue? Go.
Please go on.
The oddest thing happened. I have on January 22nd, 2003, which to me, it's, you know, when you get older, that's not long ago.
Right.
I woke up one morning and I heard you accentuate the word inexplicable, but at least you could pronounce it. Spinal cord injury. I woke up one morning with no pain and no warning, no accident, and could not walk. And had the emergency, so I don't want to focus too much on this,
yeah,
on all that, because I want to get back to Gracie.
Right.
But just briefly, I after the my spinal, it was nobody to this day. Four neurologists cannot figure out what happened. Briefly again, two vertebrae in my neck, literally overnight, disengaged, crossed over each other, and in that fast process, severed most of my spinal cord.
So, in effect, you were a quadriplegic. Paraplegic. Okay,
so,
which means that you had full function of your arms and upper body. So, where does Gracie fit in with this?
The moment I arrived home from the surgery, I had a neck brace. Well, I had a neck brace from my chin to the chest.
Right.
I could. Bob helped me hobble in. I was different. I was very different. And she usually would just hop on the couch and give me thousands of licky, glad,
yeah,
you're home, love you, Mom. She just took one look. I'll never forget this moment. She sat on the couch, looked over at me, saw me in my brace, saw pain and sad, and saw that Mom was no longer, I hate these Mom and Pop things, but
yeah,
I just can't think of anywhere else to put it. Mom was no longer the head honcho here.
Did she look depressed?
No, she looked worried. She was never depressed, ever, and she has never been depressed since. As a matter of fact, as Bob has reminded me on so many occasions, this has been the first and the happiest 8 years of her life. She has found her goal, her purpose, her protector.
How does that look? I mean, what does she actually do for you?
She is with me. This is all different from prior to 8 years ago. She is with me 24/7. She will not leave my side. When I walk, it's treacherous to walk, as you probably know.
Sure.
From the bedroom to the bathroom. If there is a slipper in my path, she's always there. She will stop, turn around, and stop me until either I get my husband Bob to help remove the slipper or I do. But I am not going to move. She's going to make sure of it until, could be a slipper, could be a book, whatever, until that obstacle is out.
And you also went through a depression, didn't you? What was Gracie's reaction to your depression?
Gracie was very sad for my reaction, and did it. I know, but this is so anthropomorphic, and I'm not a believer much in that. But I'm just telling you what happened. Her reaction to my depression was to try to cheer me up. I know I sound like a crazy person, but you and I have the background of the same profession, and guess we both sound like crazy persons because of, her reaction was to cheer me up. To put her, when I would cry, she would put her hand, her face under my hands, lift me up. She'd lick, she'd kiss. She would bring me a toy. This is nothing she was trained to do. That's my, what people think, she's a service dog. She took this all upon herself. Even if the other dogs are eating, I'm going to interrupt you because I'm going to forget. At breakfast, in the morning, she will not leave until she makes sure I am safely out of that bed. You can hear the other dog and the other cats eating, crunching now. She will not leave. She'd stay there for days.
Well, let's bring Corinne into the discussion. Corinne?
Hello.
Hi. I guess you're not terribly surprised by what you're hearing from Sarah Lee.
Oh, absolutely not. I think dogs have a very innate ability to pick up emotions of, you know, humans and, you know, around them. And with Canine Companions for Independence, we specifically train these dogs to assist people with disabilities. So while they're very task-oriented, they're going to retrieve objects, turn on a light switch, open a door, help pull a wheelchair up a curb cut, you know, whatever is needed, we train these dogs to do that. But they also provide, you know, a very high level of companionship because a lot of times, you know, they're able to increase someone's independence. So, say someone that's a quadriplegic, that dog is there with that person all the time. Someone doesn't have to be there.
Like Gracie.
Right, right. And, you know, just an example is a very good friend of mine now. She had a fall prior to receiving her service dog, and she's a quadriplegic. And fell. No one knew she fell. She was there for 8 hours. It became a life-threatening situation. Had her dog been there, you know, this was prior to her getting her service dog.
Mm-hmm.
Now that she has her service dog, she can tell her dog to bark on command. He'll continue to bark until help arrives. You know, her neighbors around her are aware that this dog is trained. There's a home monitoring system. If she's not able to push the button herself to get help, she'll train this dog. He has all the skills, you know, necessary. She'll just, you know, pattern it to tell this dog to go push the panic button. Help will arrive. So it's able to help her live a more independent life through, you know, use of these tasks as well as his companionship.
Hmm. Yeah. As an aside, I don't know if you're aware that I'm a quadriplegic and have always been interested in companion dogs. And you know, any chance we could train one to change a catheter? Because man, that would change my life completely.
Oh God!
Sorry about that.
That's
Sorry.
A great image.
thanks very much. Corinne, I'm curious about the training of these dogs. Of course, they need 8 weeks of bonding with their, I guess, mothers. But tell us what happens after those 8 weeks.
Sure. Canine Companions for Independence has a breeding program in California where we specifically chosen Labradors and Golden Retrievers and Golden Lab crosses. We've selected them for their health and their temperament. So we know these dogs are very sound dogs. They're not going to, you know, take off after a squirrel. You know, we know the level of prey drive. There's, you know, we're not going to select a dog that has any aggression or extreme fear. So these are very sound dogs. So they, you know, live the 8 weeks old till they're 8 weeks of age with their mother, and then they fly across the country to volunteer puppy raisers. Puppy raisers receive the puppies when they're 8 weeks of old, 8 weeks of age, and then their main job is to socialize these puppies, get them out in their communities, get them used to going to a grocery store.
And that's you. You're a puppy raiser.
Correct, yes. And so I'm also responsible for teaching each puppy approximately 27 commands. So these dogs are learning to grow up in a society and be invisible. They're not going to be a disruption. They're not going to be barking in a restaurant. You know, they're not going to be eating off the floor. So all this prepares the dog for its formal final training with a professional Canine Companions for Independent staff.
Give us a sense of those 27 commands. Just give us a handful.
Sure. Everything from, you know, sit, down, stay, stand, roll, to having a dog doing up onto a wall, and then also teaching that dog to shake. And when it's in its final phases of training, that will be, you know, enable the dog to turn on the light switch or to turn it off, just on a simple command.
What does shake mean?
Shake means to offer their paw.
Oh, that kind of shake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so all these commands will build up to their final formal training when they're, you know, graduate as a service dog.
Huh. And what goes on to the final training?
The final training is between 6 and 9 months, and that occurs at the 5 different regional training centers of Canine Companions for Independence. And those trainers are professional. This is their job. And they train their strings of dogs to retrieve objects, turn on light switches, help pull a wheelchair if that's, you know, the dog's strong ability. And to create these tasks that these dogs know and love to do. And then they're going to look at their waiting list of applicants that have applied to receive one of these dogs completely free of charge to come into the training. They work at the training center, an applicant that's receiving an assistance dog. They'll work with that dog and the staff for 2 weeks to make sure that match is perfect between that dog and the recipient.
You know, all pet owners should have 2 weeks of training.
Yeah, absolutely.
Pets. I didn't talk about it with you, but, you know, I talked about it with Sarah Lee, that the underlying issue here with any companion is about love and safety and trust and those kinds of deep, important human emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine that's natural for a dog, so that doesn't have to be trained, or does it?
We have a very selective process in our program in Kin and Companions for Independence, and we want these dogs to love to work. If a dog doesn't love it, you know, he's going to become a pet and not an assistance dog. So the dogs that make it to graduation are, you know, sound. They're going to be invisible when they go to a restaurant. They're going to be more than happy to pick up whatever is dropped, do whatever task is asked of them. It's a big game for them, and they love it, and they love who they work for. You know, and just that short 2 week training, the initial applicant, when they're receiving their assistance dog, those dogs bond so quickly to that new person. And then to see them a year later, it's, you know, an unbreakable bond where the dog just, you know, will seek out that person if they're up playing in a yard with other dogs.
Oh, that's got to feel great.
Absolutely.
Let's see if we get another caller or two in. We've got Allison on the line. Hi, Allison.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Much like Sarah Lee, I went through two bouts of very serious depression. And for about a year, I really would not leave my apartment unless I absolutely had to, or, you know, perform the necessary functions to care for myself. But, you know, when it came to my dog, I knew that I still had to take care of him and, you know, love him the same way I always had. And that enabled me to get the strength together to go outside every day and to get up off the couch to do even the simplest things.
Were you being treated for your depression also?
Yes, and I'm just pulling out of the second round right now. But I'd so isolated myself that my dog really helped me even go up to people and talk to people during the day. So I wasn't so alone.
Wow, what a wonderful story. Is this similar to your experience, Sarah Lee?
I just wrote a note to myself that you're... forgive me,
Allison.
I've forgotten who called. Name of the caller?
Allison.
I thought, boy, you sound very much like me. And one of the reasons I'm still around, and I'm very open, by the way, so don't worry about what you ask me, is because... All I had to do was look at Gracie and how, you know, I mean, I adore my husband now, but we had tremendous, tremendous difficulties. But when we were talking of 2 years after this all happened, I would just sit with Gracie, and it was her beauty and her genuineness and her... I was not going to let her stop her from giving it her best shot. I said, as I said to another interviewer, I said, when I bottomed out 2 years ago, 2 years into this, so that must have been 2005, I said, and I don't blame, I need to say this quickly, most marriages have a lot of problems when these things happen.
Sure.
And ours was primarily because I refused to try. Because my doctors told me I couldn't.
Right.
Nothing. Zero, zilch, no therapy, psychotherapy, no nothing therapy. And I believed it, and because of that, my husband was rather frustrated with me, and I don't blame him, and I would yell, look, you think you know better than every neurologist in the world?
So Gracie became like a marital therapist for you. I've got to...
Yes.
Allison, thanks so much for your call. How's Gracie's health now?
It's so beautiful. She's her vision is clouded. It's not cataracts, but she can only see shapes. She can hardly walk. She will not walk. She will not, and neither can I. I mean, I can walk, but just at her same pace. And she does not hear. So I've said, how does she know when I get out of bed? And I found the answer is that she sleeps next to my bed on a heated doggy bed, and she feels the vibration of me getting out of bed, wakes up instantly.
Amazing.
Slows just like gets up and stands there till she would stand there, as I said, until she knows I'm okay, and she will not leave my side. She knows my shape compared to the other shapes in the house.
Hmm. Which, I mean, that raises an interesting question. We're running out of time. A quick question for you, Corin. What happens to these dogs who either don't make the cut or when they're ready for retirement?
With Canine Companions for Independence, the dogs that are not fit to be a service dog, so it could be for a variety of reasons. It could be high energy and distractible. That dog, we want to help them work if that mm-hmm. is working for them. So, a bomb squad dog, a drug sniffing.
Great.
We've sent dogs to dogs for diabetics to help with their program. So if there's a job out there for them, we send them that way. If you have a dog that is just clearly not enjoying it, fearful, anxious, something like that, that's going to become a very well-loved pet. Pets do become therapy dogs.
And I guess we're running out of time, so when it comes time for retirement, I guess that's the pet owner's decision to decide about retirement.
It happens between the organization and the recipient.
Right.
So it's a communication happens the entire time they have that dog.
Well, I want to tell you, I it's a wonderful organization, and it does a lot of good. I want to thank you both so much for joining us.
This is great.
It's been great. We've been learning about therapy and service dogs with Corin Levy, and Corin raises service puppies for Canine Companions. Earlier, we also heard from Sarah Lee Perel, whose dog Gracie is one of her, probably her main caregiver. And earlier on, we heard from Harold Herzog and Alan McConnell. Both have written and researched about pets and people. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to hear all about migraines. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Kevin Griffin. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer for audio content. Our intern's Emily Haas. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.